With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
That's my dog!
Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, we have a very special guest. We're going to go out to the Bay Area and be joined by a four-time Super Bowl champion, one of the greatest football players in NFL history, Ronnie Lott. Welcome to Speak for Yourself. And let's start with a relatively easy question. They made it almost illegal to tackle in the NFL, Ronnie. And I want to know, could Ronnie Lott be Ronnie Lott in today's NFL where you have to, like, ask a wide receiver for permission before you tackle him?
First of all, let me say this. I love the game. And not only do I love the game, I love the new rules. And the reason I love the new rules is that you have to go find a way to hit in a different spot. The question is, man, which I think, and Barry Bonds once told me this when they changed the strike zone. I said, Barry, what'd you do? He goes, well, I went to work and to understand that the strike zone is different. I would go to work. And it's pretty simple when you think about going to work, man. And the idea of what we've seen here recently and watching, you know, the Jordan, the Last Dance, he went to work. If you want to be a champion, you got to go to work, man. And one of the great things about hitting or about doing anything is that you got to find a new target. And I think one of the great things that we've seen so far is that guys have found a new way of attacking and getting after guys. So I enjoy the game. I still see some of them woo hits. And I still see some guys, you know, hitting really hard. And the sad part is we focus on the things that people's, I mean, I'm yesterday's news. You know, when you think about guys who played in the era yesterday's news. Today, what we're looking at I just want you to know, they got guys right now that are phenomenal football players, and I have the utmost respect for how they go out and not only play the game, but how they perfect the game.
Let me ask you this, Ronnie. Pretend like we're off camera, and I want what you would tell me in private. Is Ronnie Lott the greatest defensive back of all time? We're not on camera.
Well, look, man, and I know this. Because I played three different positions, and those three different positions that I played, I tried to be the best. And the only reason I tried to be the best in those three different positions is that they gave me the opportunity and the privilege to try it. And so for me, you know, I've always said this, you got to exhaust every moment. And that's all I was trying to do, is exhaust every moment. But to say that I'm one of the best ever as a defensive back, hey man, I'm very humbled by some of the people that have come before me and some of the people that will come after me. And I'm glad I'm in the conversation. I'm glad I'm in the conversation with Ed Reed. I'm glad I'm in the conversation with Deion Sanders. I'm glad I'm in the conversation with some of the guys that Rod Woodson. I'm glad I'm in the conversation. Kenny Easley, I'm glad I'm in the conversation because I have the ultimate respect for how he played the game. So there are some guys, Mel Blount. I can go down the list and you start to realize Night Train Lane. You start to realize, I mean, there's some guys that you just want to sniff them because that's how good they were. That's how great they were. And so, yeah, all right, all of those guys I mentioned.
I'm going to pass the baton. I'm going to pass the baton to Marcellus because you'll probably dodge my next question as well. But I just want to enter it into the record, Marcellus, before you change the topic. He's the only guy, Pro Bowl at three different positions, corner, free safety, strong safety. Rod Woodson, I think maybe Pro Bowl at two positions, maybe Charles Woodson as well, but no one else at three positions. One of the greatest defensive players, if not the greatest defensive player of all time. Marcellus.
Yeah. Well, thanks for passing it to a guy who struggled to make the Pro Bowl in just one position. And you know what? Damn it, I'm still proud of it. Hey, Ronnie, being real, man, respect to you, you're a living legend. But how much did you benefit going every day to practice against one of the most potent offenses the NFL has ever seen? Talking about Joe Montana, Jerry Rice, and the architect, the coach, and Bill Walsh.
Hey, man, to me, thinking of what you just said and knowing what you have to do against that group of guys every day, I tell people this, is that Jerry Rice, to me, is arguably our Michael Jordan. And if you watched him work every day from Monday through Saturday, and then, of course, on Sunday, we got him. We got to, you know, we were watching him. But from Monday through Saturday, just like Michael, he did everything. I mean, everything that you could possibly do to be great. And not only great, but the competitor of him was, hey, man, I'm going to get you. And not only am I going to get you, but I'm going to work you every day. And so you're absolutely right, man. I benefited from Bill Walsh. I benefited from all of those guys. But more importantly, I benefited from my coaches, you know, Ray Rhodes and George Seifert and those guys. And then in the secondary, man, we had an incredible secondary. Eric Wright, Carlton Williamson, Dwight Hicks. That secondary in 84 went to the Pro Bowl, all of us. I don't know if anybody's ever done that, but all of us went because we had that kind of, I'm going to get you or I'm going to top you, and somebody else would come back and say, wait a minute, no. I'm going to outdo you. And so we had that camaraderie and that competition, as you pointed out, within the locker room and within the group of guys.
Well, let's stick to that word competition, because everyone, including you, is hearing the GOAT conversation. Everyone's saying Tom Brady. But in the spirit of competition, where does Joe Montana land? Is he better? Is he the true GOAT?
So I as I'm sitting here, I can tell you right now, man, Joe Money, it's hard for me to say that Tom Brady is better than Joe Money. And the reason why is that I just have watched so many times when I thought that there was no opportunity to win, that we ended up winning. And Joe Money is just one of those kind of guys that I'm always going to bet on, because there's something about the moment when you have to make it happen. I mean, obviously, Tom has done it time and time and time and time again as well. But he has also had the moments where it has cracked. And so when you got a guy like Joe who has been in those situations where he didn't allow it to crack, I'm going with Joe Money.
Ronnie, I keep hearing you reference Michael Jordan. You watched the Last Dance documentary. I want to know from your perspective as a football player and a guy that made his bones in the 80s, what do you think of Michael Jordan's leadership style? Some people saying he was a bully. How do you think you would have responded to that? Or was that the same kind of culture you guys had in football in the 80s?
Hey, man, the one thing that do you know how hard it is to win? Do you really understand how hard it is to get four? And by the way, we were trying to get three in a row. And I'm telling you, I'm still mad because we lost to the Giants. So winning is hard. And all Michael was saying to everybody, understand, even the greatest, it has to be such that you don't let nothing stay on the table. You got to eat it all. And that's one of the great things that we saw is that he said, hey, Detroit, I got to get stronger. I got to work. They're killing me. They're bumping me. The fact is, we all have moments like that where somebody is bigger than you, stronger than you, and then you find a way. And that's the bit, to me, the beauty of all of it, man, to me, is that that kind of leadership is, like he said, I want everybody to do what I can do. And I'm telling you, Jerry Rice would say the same thing. Joe Montana would say the same thing. Because those guys understand how hard it is to win. And winning for all of us is so tough, man. It is so tough. And to do what he was able to do, three in a row, back to back, yeah, I can smell it, man. That stuff is good. That is good. That's some good. That is an incredible smell. That is an incredible smell. Only, and by the way, only he can say it. You know, only he can say what. And so there's something about that that I marvel in it, because when I first met him, I just thought about not him, but the spirit of who he is, man. And I'm just I admire his spirit. I admire his competition. But there are guys like that, like Larry and Magic. And we saw so many guys that have, and by the way, this hat I'm wearing is for a reason, because you got my boy Steph and Draymond, and you know, and that kid Michael's son, you know, and so you got some dogs right now up in San Francisco that will fight you, and they love playing, so I can't wait for them to get back on the court.
And legend, let's talk about your passion. Saw you last at your award ceremony, Lott Impact Trophy Award. And let's just talk about your passion for counseling athletes and making that transition into the business world. You've had a successful transition, obviously, but talk about your passion and making sure that other guys can do as well.
You know, life is about how somebody says something to you to help you get better. There are many moments where somebody has whispered in my ear, like Deacon Jones, when I was a young kid, said, hey, man, be the best. Or Jim Brown whispering in my ear, man, you know, you can do this. Or Mean Joe Green. And my point is that you can go down the list of people giving you wisdom all the time. Even now, as you live the rest of your life, you got to find wisdom. And so one of the things that I've always said is, man, I've seen guys give me so much. I've seen guys that sat down with me and told me stories and shared with me the things that I should be doing in my life. Gene Washington sitting down, Jimmy Johnson sitting down with me. And you think about those guys, some of the greatest 49ers ever, but they would sit down and talk to me about the game, about life. And so it's important for all of us to take on that responsibility to make sure that we pass it forward, man. That is the greatest gift that we can give another human being, is ourselves.
Ronnie, thank you so much for taking the time. It was great to have you. Go Warriors, go 49ers, except when they play the Chiefs. Well, fans, NASCAR is back. Tonight on FS1, we've got Xfinity Series racing. Then tomorrow night, we finish up at Darlington, the Toyota 500, live and in prime time, only on FS1. And Sunday, we're back on Fox for the Coca-Cola 600, live in Charlotte.
That's my dog!
All right, welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib. Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. Speak for Yourself presented by Hyundai. Time for us to pull up at Kevin Harvick's crib. Kevin Harvick, the winner of this past Sunday's Real Heroes 400. Kevin, 6 million viewers watching at home. That's a Daytona 500-like number, but no one in the grandstands. What was that experience like for you, racing without anybody in the grandstands?
Yeah, well, for me, it was the most unique and really caught my attention the most when I got out after the race, because as a driver, you know, during the race, there's really not that much difference of what you see and don't see in the grandstands other than a flashbulb, you know. And so getting out after that race and have all that excitement and enthusiasm built up and nobody to share it with, I realized how much we actually feed off of the crowd and the things that you say, the things that you do. And it was very awkward for me after the race because, you know, I didn't really know what to do because there wasn't anything to feed off of. So not being able to see my guys' faces behind their masks on pit road, nobody in victory lane, it was a very different situation. But I think as you look at the job that NASCAR did and everybody in the industry to get our sport back on track, they did a great job keeping everybody safe and we were able to go back to work.
Look, it's a victory you'll never forget for a lot of reasons. You guys, NASCAR, helped bring us back a little bit of normalcy as we try to recover from this pandemic. And for you individually, your 50th career win, only 14 drivers have done that. What's it like to be in that elite company?
Well, there's definitely, I feel a sense of responsibility there when you put your name next to Ned Jarrett's and you know, the likes of the Jarrett family. Junior Johnson obviously is the other, and those guys are both Hall of Famers and both have meant so much to this sport. So the first thing that I did was ask myself, have you done enough to live up to the expectations of what those guys did for the sport and carrying that responsibility forward and making sure that you remember that. So it's a good reality check for me. Obviously I've been very fortunate to be competitive and win a bunch of races, but there's way more responsibility to our sport than just winning races. Are we going to be able to hand it off, you know, to the next generation of guys so that they can carry it forward? So it definitely brought a lot of that thought process to me as I hear people talking about those names.
Now you're right back at Darlington tomorrow night on FS1 Toyota 500. And you're driving the same car that you drove on Sunday. What went into that decision and what are the risks involved?
Yeah, that's old school. We normally, it takes about a month and a half to turn the car around. The guys have been in a unique situation at the shop with all the new no qualifying procedures, and they didn't work for a few weeks because of everybody being locked out of the shop during this pandemic. So it also helps us catch up. You know, from a performance side, you're very comfortable with that car and feel like you can make good adjustments on it. But it also gives us a little bit of padding as we go into these next several races, racing Sunday, Wednesday, to have a little cushion on your car count and not put the guys in the shop in a bind. So, look, for me, they all fit the same, right? And you got to have faith in what the guys are bringing to the racetrack. All my seats are custom. My dashers are the same. Steering wheels are the same. So that's what they wanted to do. And I'm a team guy, so... whatever they say, I'm buying into what they say, and let's go do it again.
Now, you mentioned no qualifiers for this Wednesday's race, so the top 20 finishers are inverted, so that puts you in a 20th spot. You have any issue with how NASCAR is handling this?
Look, we were the points leader going into this, and typically during a rainout or some of these instances, they would line the field up by points. And, you know, I think everybody just assumed that they were going to do that. But I think there's a responsibility here to make this entertaining because we are in the entertainment business. And we need to make sure that it doesn't look the same on pit road every time with the same guys having the first pit stall, the same guys starting up front. So in this particular instance, I'm for it. I think it's going to add some excitement and definitely some, you know, we've already got some speaking points and talking points for the media and the fans to talk about before we even get to the race. So if we can create an event before we even have the event and some talking points around it, that's always going to be a good thing for the show.
Kevin, you mentioned old school and turning the car around that quickly, but Kevin Harvick and all these racers, 4 races in 11 days, that's really old school. What have you done to prepare yourself for this kind of workload?
Yeah, well, I tried to start preparing myself as we got into, you know, this break. And, you know, I've tried to ride my road bike a lot more than I ever had before. It was really a goal of mine to try to do in the past. And now I just told myself, I said, you got to do something different to make yourself be mentally prepared for whatever's in front of you, be physically prepared. So, you know, I've tried to, put some serious miles in on the road bike. I've tried to become a better runner. And then I've got a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old here that I have to entertain as well. So really that's the motivator in the workout. So my 7-year-old and I, I make him run 2 miles every morning. So I go with him. And so we've tried to stay active. And the most important thing for us is hydration. I do a few different things. I use a lot of red light therapy with the Juve machine. Just try to take care of yourself from a fitness standpoint as I would, whether I'm in or out of the car, from a cardio standpoint.
Kevin, we're out of time. Thank you so much. On your way out, I'm a degenerate gambler.
Thank you, brother.
I'm going to be betting on Wednesday. Give me a thumbs up if I should double down on Kevin Harvick or not and win some money that way on my Fox Bet app. Give me a thumbs up if I should bet on Kevin Harvick.
Look,
we
got
to keep it moving. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the Crib, presented by Hyundai, Jason Whitlock, Marcellus Wiley. All right, we're about to do an interview I've been looking forward to since the beginning of the Last Dance documentary, certainly since they focused on Michael Jordan and the Bulls' rivalry with the Detroit Pistons. All right, let's go out to New York and bring in Isaiah Thomas. Just for transparency, Isaiah Thomas is one of my favorite human beings on the planet. I just want to establish that up front. I probably got a little bit of bias here, but not really. I'm going to keep it real. Isaiah, thank you for joining us. We heard during this documentary, 10-part documentary, Michael Jordan called you an asshole, said that he hates you, has animus over the lack of a handshake and the supposed lack of respect. We know how Michael Jordan feels about you. How do you feel about Michael Jordan?
First of all, I was shocked to hear that from him because... he and his producer, they actually approached me to sit down and do the interview for The Last Dance. And, you know, we went back and forth in terms of timing and place and finally settled on doing the interview. And, you know, I got from his producer that they wanted me to be involved and I chose to be involved. And I didn't know that this is what was coming because... You know, he and I have been to dinner before. He, Ahmad Rashad, and I have been to dinner before. We've seen each other in different places at NBA functions, and I never got any type of animosity or bad feelings from him towards me. So I don't have any bad feelings towards Michael Jordan, or have I ever had any bad feelings towards Michael Jordan. I'm like me and my family who sat down to watch The Last Dance. We were pretty surprised to hear those words come out of his mouth, especially since it was following, an apology that I had given to him on national television.
You kind of answered this question, so you don't have to spend long on it, but was there anything that transpired off the court between you and Michael that may fuel this level of animus 30 years down the road?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, really, I think the only thing that people kind of go back to is, and I've said this, the lapse in judgment that I had, in terms of not shaking his hand after a game. Just to contextualize that and give you the full narrative around that, you know, before that, they won, I think it was after game 3, Michael Jordan called us undeserving champions and said that, you know, we were bad for basketball and everything else. Now, we had a long, hard journey to become champions. We had to fight through Boston. We had to fight through L.A. And we had a lot of ups and downs, just like every champion does. And we felt that we deserved our championship and worked hard to get it. And to have him say that we were undeserving, that really did cut. And it cut deep. So when we got beat and we got swept and they won, they beat us 4-0. A lot went into that, you know, first we were celebrating with each other, thanking each other for our journey. But then a decision was made. Lambert said, hey, let's, you know, we just gonna, you know, walk off. And that's what we did. Now, was it the right thing to do? Probably not, looking back 30 years later. But what went into that in terms of our emotions, the way the city was feeling at that time, for someone to call us undeserving in terms of what we had been through, at that particular moment, we didn't feel that they deserved a handshake either. So now, was that the right thing to do looking back 30 years from now? No, it wasn't. We should have been bigger as champions, and I should have been bigger as a person to really stop and ignore the noise that had come after game three and did the right thing. And I apologize for that. I did it. I'm doing it now, and I did it back then too. So I don't know why he has animosity that he's exhibited. He seems to be angry at a lot of people right now.
I would agree. Mm. He seems to be a guy that holds a grudge as well. And I'm just wondering if this could be a competitive thing, because people don't realize this, but you're only 1 year older than Michael Jordan. You entered the league before him, but you're really only 1 year older. And during the 1980s, when you were in your prime, in the 1980s, before you hurt your wrist, before you got on the other side of your career, you were pretty dominant over Michael Jordan, 32-16 in the 1980s, in the regular season and postseason. Could this just be a competitive thing from you and the Pistons beating up on him, wins and losses?
It could be from his point of view. And by the way, that number should be 37-16, including playoffs. And so Michael Jordan at that time, from 84 to 90, in 91, I had basically what they would call career-ending wrist surgery. And, you know, I never was the same again. But when we were all young and healthy, from 84 to 90, you know, the numbers speak for themselves. You know, he wasn't really my competition. My competition was Bird and Magic, trying to catch the Celtics, trying to catch the Lakers. You know, Chicago at that time, and Jordan at that time, from 84 to 90, before my wrist surgery, you know, he just, that wasn't my competition.
Let's stay there for a minute. In the 80s, because he didn't have tremendous success against you, Magic, or Larry. But then, once you guys started to come down the hill somewhat, you saw his ascension and dominance. Is that how you guys felt?
Well, and that's a natural progression of the champion and of teams throughout the league. I mean, when Boston was at their absolute best, we gave them competition, but they were better than us. I mean, and as they got older, as they got a little bit more banged up, we were able to catch them. Now, what we were able to learn from Boston during that process, the Detroit Pistons, and every time you hear us talk about who we are, what we became, we do not mention ourselves as champions without saying the Boston Celtics, because those were our teachers. Those were our mentors. Those are the people that really taught us how to win, and they gave us the heartaches. And Bird, Mikhail, DJ, Ainge, you know, Max, I mean, ML Carr, Perry, they were great to us as teachers. And when we got to go to the finals and finally beat them, then I ran into another one of my mentors, which was Magic Johnson, who had let me become a student under him, learning how to win championships in the NBA. Learning that Laker organization, learning that Celtic organization. And I'm sure all of you can look back and remember, you saw me at every NBA Finals game when the Celtics and the Lakers were playing. And not only was I there as a fan, but I was there as a student, taking notes, learning how to win, how to put together an organization, and not just be a basketball player in the NBA, but to become a champion. And that's what we became. We became a champion, and we were pretty dominant in our era.
And yesterday, during an ESPN interview, Horace Grant accused Michael Jordan of being dishonest in the documentary. Do you think the documentary portrayed you and the Pistons honestly?
You know, this is a question that I think people, I would hope people would one day go back and watch the games that the Pistons played, that we actually played in, because the narrative about us over the last, you know, 20 plus years has been, you know, you take a couple of clips of some hard fouls, and then you say, okay, this is Detroit Pistons. You take a couple of movie clips, and then you put some words around it, and you say, this is the Detroit Pistons. No, that was part of us, but that was also part of the NBA. And as a matter of fact, that was part of the Chicago Bulls, too. I mean, Charles Oakley, who people say probably is the toughest player and the toughest person to ever come through the NBA. Well, guess what? He was a teammate of Michael Jordan's, okay? Horace Grant was a teammate of Michael Jordan. Bill Cartwright, you know, those guys were tough people. So it wasn't like, you know, we just came in and bullied them and beat them up. Okay, well, they bullied us and beat us up too. I got some scars on my head from Bill Cartwright. I got some blood coming down my eyes just as much as Jordan got hit. I got hit just as hard. We didn't complain about it. That was just part of the game. You see Robert Parrish knocking Lambeer's head off in a playoff game. We got up, we played the next game. I mean, that's just how it was then. But, you know, so this narrative about the Pistons were so rough and tough and everybody was so soft, so they had to legislate the game because the Pistons were beating everybody up. Time out. That's not quite how I remember.
You anticipate seeing Michael Jordan at some point and clearing the air of why he would hate you 30 years later?
So first of all, there's no air to clear from my point of view, because I genuinely don't have anything against him, nor did I ever. I'm not that kind of guy. I played out on the floor in between the four lines, and I'm okay with saying, you know, the time that we competed when we were both young and healthy, and he didn't have injuries and I didn't have injuries, I'm pretty confident in saying, you know, my record was pretty dominant against him and against his team and in terms of my team. Now, outside of the four lines, I got nothing but love and respect for the brother in terms of, you know, who he is, what he's done, and what he's accomplished. You know, we as former players, current players, you know, we owe a great deal of debt to Michael Jordan and LeBron James, because what those two have done for all league and all game financially and raised it to another level, you know, it's been great for all of us. We get to be on this show and talk basketball 24/7, 365 during COVID because of what, you know, Jordan has done and what LeBron has done. So, you know, we as a collective family, brotherhood, so forth and so on, I believe in that. And that's what I live by and go by. So I don't have anything against the brother. Now, if he puts on number 23 and I put on number 11, okay, yeah, we're going to go compete. But outside of that, that's all it was for me.
You mentioned the importance of Michael Jordan in terms of elevating the league. That, to me, says that the league had a major investment in Michael Jordan. David Stern and the whole league, they poured all their chips into Michael Jordan. He was the establishment. You, as the head of the players' union during your playing career, you went head-to-head with David Stern and the league. Real battles that you did pretty well in. Did you know at the time that you were taking on the establishment the way that you were, and that it would define your post-career the way that it has?
Absolutely, we did. Not only myself, but the Detroit Pistons as a small market and what we stood for in the game of basketball at that particular time. Because at that particular time, no small market team had ever dominated the way we were dominating. It was always Boston, LA, Philadelphia, and Chicago. Those were the four big markets that the league wanted to promote. And we as a Players Association and players knew that it helped when those four markets were doing well, that the league does well. Now, what we were able to do as a small market team is to create the next generation for a San Antonio Spurs to happen. Because the San Antonio Spurs, what they became is really, you know, the fast forward or uptick of what the Pistons were in Detroit. Small markets team dominating, so forth and so on. The other thing that we were able to do from we were the first team to experiment with changing all colors. We were the first team, we went to the silver and black, you know, the Raider colors, because we met Al Davis after Pat Riley wouldn't give me no ice after I sprained my ankle game six. We had to go to the Raiders facility to train to try to heal up. But, you know, so we took on the silver and black. Mike Ornstein gave us the Raider logos and everything else. So we started playing with all colors. Not only did we start playing with all colors while I was the president of the Players Association moving forward, then we start upgrading our hotel. So instead of staying at, you know, the three-star hotels, we upgraded and went to the five-star hotels. We changed our travel. We were the first team to get our own private plane and start moving around the league. So that, of course, we knew we were attacking the establishment. And the establishment didn't like what we were doing and what we were representing, not only as team, but also as players. The things that we were talking about in terms of race, class, and gender that was coming out of our Pistons organization, that was coming out of, you know, our interviews, the discourse that we put out into the public, we were very, you know, against what, not against, but forward thinking in terms of where the league was going and where we thought the league should be. So, you know, and when you asked me, did I know that we was going against the establishment? So that question is absolutely yes. And by the way, we saw Michael Jordan as part of us as a union, as a players group. And by the way, all those guys that they said don't like me, they voted me to be their president and represent them. but Michael Jordan was, at that time, we were getting 53% of the gross. So when we looked at Michael Jordan, not only did we look at him as a great basketball player and someone who was elevating the league, but we also looked at him as 53% of the gross. So he was one of us, and he was helping uplift the league. So my job as the president was to make sure that we kept the 53 cents on a dollar, and the owners kept 47. Well, at that time, they wanted a little bit more, and we fought and battled. And I'll say, you know, most of the battles, when I was president of the union and vice president of the union, we won most of our battles at the negotiating table, if not
Isaiah,
all.
Isaiah, final question before we go to commercial break, and we'll come back with some more questions. But if you could answer this in 60, 90 seconds, and take as long as you want. Michael Jordan called y'all bad for basketball before sweeping y'all. Listening to what you just said about the league and his importance and elevating, could you understand why David Stern and perhaps the league thought the Pistons were bad for basketball? Because y'all were standing in the way of Michael Jordan.
Yeah, I can understand the way that they were thinking it, probably in the league office, because monetarily, as we've seen, you know, this is a business too. And you definitely, you know, while the Pistons were making money and the Bad Boys were making money, you know, in the 80s, the highest rated games in the 80s, Pistons versus Celtics, Pistons versus Chicago, Pistons versus Lakers. They have one thing in common, the Detroit Pistons. So the highest rated games in the 80s were the games that we played in. The merchandise that was selling at that time, you know, Bad Boy Piston merchandise, you know, people were wearing it everywhere. And then when you look at the crowds that we were bringing in at that time, we were putting, you know, 40, 50, 60,000 people in the Silver Dome. So what we were doing energetically and also what we were doing from a financial standpoint, we were bringing more people to the game. Now, what league office understood is that Jordan and Chicago being a bigger market than Detroit, Jordan having a Nike behind him that was moving into marketing, those connections and those two together definitely, you know, elevated him in our league, in us as players, to another level. So I do understand the business aspect of it.
All right, don't go anywhere. Isaiah Thomas is going to rejoin us, and Marcellus is going to ask him, would Michael Jordan be Michael Jordan without Isaiah Thomas? Speak for yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. More after this. Welcome back to Speak for Yourself from the crib, presented by Hyundai. All right, we're going to continue on with our interview with Isaiah Thomas, who was a co-star in the Last Dance documentary. Marcellus, keep us rolling.
I get an interview?
Isaiah. Yeah, we're going back, man. And I loved how you said your wars with the Boston Celtics helped you guys as the Detroit Pistons on your journey. Now, I want to know, do you feel that you and the Pistons going to battle with Michael Jordan has helped Michael Jordan became what he was and what he is?
You know, that's for him to speak to. You know, I can only really tell you about my journey and who my teachers and mentors were and what I learned from losing and what I learned from them and give them credit for it. You know, he has to speak for his journey and he speaks for himself. And I can tell you who, you know, Magic and Bird and Julius Erving definitely helped make me the champion that I became in the NBA. The Lakers and the Celtics and the Philadelphia 76ers definitely helped shape the Detroit Pistons into becoming the champions that we became as a basketball team.
Okay, here's one that I know you can answer, and it's going to be in your words, and I want to go deep to the heart. Do you feel that Michael Jordan had no role in you making the Dream Team? Be real.
You know, up until the Last Dance, I didn't think he did, you know, and I took him at his word. But now listening to him and Rod Thorne and how they portray me, and you know, I kind of question it now. you got to question it, you know. But up until then, you know, up until I guess last week, I hadn't laid that card on him, nor had I laid it on anyone. But just watching a documentary and seeing how he and Rob were talking and communicating, there's, you know, I guess in his words, having me around would have made him feel uncomfortable. So,
Isaiah, One of the observations I had watching this documentary that kind of took me by surprise is, like, I started thinking, like, Isaiah and Larry Bird are more alike than Isaiah and Magic Johnson, Isaiah and Michael Jordan. You and Larry come from tough, hard-knock backgrounds. Michael and Magic come from nuclear, middle-class families. They're kind of corporate and glitzy. You and Larry Bird, kind of lunch pail, rough competitors. Has that ever crossed your mind that it's like you and Larry actually have more in common than Michael and Magic?
You know, and then we, you know, both, he played at Indiana State, I played at Indiana. You know, definitely there's a lot of commonality there. And Larry and I have always had a great relationship. And whenever we got out on the floor, you know, you can see in All-Star games, like, he and I, we just magically connected and always, you know, found each other. And when the, you know, the the whole thing that in terms of competing against the Celtics and watching our team grow, you know, Larry, Kevin, Dennis Johnson, and ML Carr, them guys were constantly, you know, doing an exhibition season, you know, even though they would be shooting, you know, little jabs at you, but they was always letting you know, you're getting closer. And I never forget the first time Larry played against Dennis Rodman. We were in Hartford, Connecticut. We had just drafted Dennis and we were playing down in Hartford. And I told Larry, when they were getting off the bus, I said, I got something for you this year. This guy Rodman, you know, he can defend. And Larry's like, nah, we'll see when we get out on the court. So this exhibition game, we like talking trash, so forth and so on. Anyway, they end up beating us in Hartford. But as we're getting on the bus, he looks at me and he goes, y'all got two nice rookies. And he was talking about Rodman and Sally. So every now and then they would let us know that we were on our way.
The other observation I had was the feud between you and Jordan just comes down to city kid versus suburban kid. Your thoughts?
So I'm going to call time out on the feud because really, I wasn't fighting him. I was winning all the time. I was winning the majority of the time. So why am I mad at him?
Woo, at least that competitor came out.
Yeah, at that point in time. Yeah, of course, we all competitors. I mean, all of you have played, right? You know, we play different sports, football, basketball, but absolutely we competitors. And the guy who's winning all the time or most of the time, you ain't mad at nobody. You're kind of happy.
Isaiah said, I ain't going to punch Isaiah, down. Okay, here we go. Here's the thing, Isaiah. Has the success of this documentary.
I think the Last Dance.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I think the Last Dance documentary is a good look.
You go. I'm done.
As the Last Dance doc, I think it was a good look for you. Do you agree? Overall, I think it's a good look for you.
I think for the Detroit Pistons and also historians of the game, because what the Last Dance has done, it is really allowed the younger generation to really go back and take a critical look and critique the actual history of the game and recognize some players and some play that they may have overlooked. I mean, all 1990 NBA Finals, and all 1989 NBA Finals, they talk about small ball being a new thing and dominating the NBA. Well, I think what people have discovered is that in 1989, Joe Dumars, small shooting guard, was the MVP of the Finals. 1990, Isaiah Thomas, point guard, small point guard, MVP of the NBA Finals. And then when you look at our three-point shooting ability during 89 and 90 and where we had evolved to as a basketball team and what Bill Laimbeer was as a three-point shooting center, you know, we still hold records from the three-point line in the NBA Finals in terms of field goal percentage. Now, fast forward to 2020 that we're in now, when everyone was talking about, oh, the game has evolved. I think what Last Dance has brought them back to from an offensive standpoint is like more teams play like the Detroit Pistons now and more point guards play like Isaiah Thomas and Joe Dumars now than they were back then. So the impact and influence that we've had on the game is starting to be recognized now, because I would venture to say there in the NBA right now, there's more backcourts like Dumars and I than there are like, you know, Pippen and Jordan. And I'll say, and let me just say this, I don't mean that as a slight. I mean that because Pippen and Jordan we're such freaks as athletes that it's very difficult to find a Pippen and a Jordan with that type of athleticism that you can put out on the floor together. It's easier to find an Isaiah and a Dumars and make a team. Athletically, what Pippen and Jordan were together out on the floor, those two are rare, and they, you know, they show up every 60 years or so.
Now, you speak to influence. Has the success of the documentary, has that made you want to go out there and do the Isaiah Thomas documentary?
You know, there's a time, you know, there'll be a book and there'll be a doc at the right time. And my story is a pretty interesting story from a basketball standpoint. Growing up on the west side of Chicago, activism, you know, sports, education, and you know, just coming from where I came from and representing what I represent. I hope people will find it interesting when it happens.